increase the urgency for competent soldiers in the eyes of their military leaders. The NRA and the NGA got lucky in the early 1900s. First, whatever their differences, the two parties did not differ in support of the National Guards. Democrats shared a commitment to the National Guard, despite their suspicion of the Federal Army. In the early years of the 20th century, the NRA had major allies in Washington. President McKinley, before his untimely death, his successor Teddy Roosevelt, were both National Guard officers, and so was Representative Dick of the Armed Services Committee and others. They all band together, and the NRA and the NGA filed similar plans for a civilian marksmanship program. The exact same ideas found their way to a War Department report written by none other than a National Guard officer. The plan was enacted as part of the Dick Act of 1903 and subsequent national defense laws. In addition to the federalization of the state militia, the Dick Act created a civilian marksmanship program and ordered the Army, which was not happy about this, to provide surplus firearms and ammunition for free or at cost only to NRA-affiliated gun clubs and individuals. So they established a monopoly for the NRA and its members. The government also funded NRA rifle competitions and provided soldiers for free labor. The NRA had a monopoly over civilian marksmanship training for a century, during which the draft was instituted three times. It also had monopolistic access to these discounts to arms and ammunition until 1968. Even today, the NRA is NRA certified trainers who train civilians in guns for permit purposes. And today, the NRA boasts about 5 million members, which we don't really know if that is true because we don't have access to their records.
You're listening to Alexandra Philindra on Race, Rights, and Rifles. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So strong was the monopoly of the NRA that in 1967, in the midst of the Detroit riots, the local police had to pay NRA memberships for its members in order to get access to the surplus federal guns and ammunition through the CMP. That's quite interesting. How could the government know whether criminals got access to its arms and ammunition, all these programs that were basically giving ammunition for free? So the expectation was that the NRA weeded out bad guys through its referral program. In the tradition of fraternal organizations of the late 19th and early part of the century, new members needed to get the support and referral of an existing member. These allowed the organization to remain a pretty closed club that effectively kept out people of color and immigrants, undesirable people. State laws, and specifically the Uniform Firearms Act of 1926, followed suit. The NRA card was all that was needed to assure police that guns were legally owned. So you showed your NRA card, and the police would let you go if they found guns in your car. This is the origin, in a sense, of the good guy with a gun, a card-carrying member of the National Rifle Association. An NRA membership card, that is membership to a private organization, constituted evidence of good citizenship to the degree that this person could be entrusted with a government-provided firearm, and they could be exempted from gun control legislation, such as state or local licensing and registration. The NRA narratives, and maybe more so the pictures in its magazines, tell the story of who these virtuous citizen soldiers and the good guys with the gun are. Most provocative is this cartoon from 1944 in which a black soldier, speaking in slang, tells his officer that assembling an M1 is a mystery to him. The NRA publications do the work of race mostly through implicit messaging, especially pictures. This is a very interesting ad from 1968 for a Savage rifle. And the association is pretty clear on what its vision of the virtual gun owner looks like. Respectable, employed, white men, with a couple of well-groomed women thrown in the mix. There are 25 people in this picture. Three are women. Every one of them is white. Up until 2008, there are very few pictures of non-whites featured in The American Rifleman. And we know because I had 4 graduate students go through every issue and count every picture and code them. So I can tell you exactly how many there were. From January 1960 to January 2008, I located a dozen such pictures. The first is a picture of the great white hunter on a safari. The second, related to race protests and the mayhem of the late 1960s, which is viewed very disapprovingly by the Rifleman, and it has a very interesting article in 1970 that is called Of Black Panthers and Blind Kittens. The third is a recurring ad for the Savage rifle that has the Indian chief there. The fourth is from the dedication of the Buffalo Soldiers Memorial in 1992. And anyone who reads the article and didn't know what the Buffalo Soldiers were, they would still have no clue. Then from 2008, the issues is filled with pictures of angry Obama and angry Eric Holder. There are lots and lots of them. Over the past 2 years, there seems to be a change in the association strategy. We've seen a lot of targeting of African-American women. I do not see any efforts to present black men in the magazine. And what is interesting is how these women are portrayed. They're very, very pink, very, very smiley, and very non-threatening. They exist only in the social plane. They're very interesting. They're crime victims, but they're never soldiers or citizens. Another theme that's popular is anti-Semitism. Themes and conspiracies often related to anti-Semitism, George Soros, even though he has not been involved with gun culture and gun laws, is very, very frequently portrayed in the NRA stories, and it's very problematic how the group treats the Holocaust because basically the story there is that if Jews had guns, then the Holocaust would have been avoided. And the same is true of the way they understand slavery. They have an interesting way of talking about women, too. Unlike white men, who for the most part in the history of the magazine have been depicted as citizens and soldiers, and secondarily as sportsmen and hunters, women do not exist as in the political realm. Women are rarely citizens and even less so soldiers, even though women have been officially admitted into the armed forces since 1948. From 1930 through today, only one woman soldier ever graced the cover of the magazine. The NRA typically portrays women as victims of potential victims of crime. As the weakest sex, they are in danger of being overpowered by physically stronger men who are implicitly always the danger. Their key responsibility is to protect their virtue and the life of their children. And in this context, the gun becomes a great equalizer. Interestingly, even though the issue of domestic violence has become central to the gun control debate, in the NRA, it's always about stranger danger. It's never the husband or the partner who is the danger to the woman. And they have actually doubled down on this idea, and they're calling it feminism, like gun feminism. And they are basically accusing the left of hypocrisy, that basically guns is what provides women with power, and the left, by wanting to take away guns, are actually disempowering women. And it's not their political rights, but guns that provide power to women. Today, the NRA is in decline because of internal scandals. However, even if the NRA disappears tomorrow, its worldview has been inscribed in America's law thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court decisions in Heller, McDonald, and Bruin. This new institutional environment opens up a whole bunch of new questions, both theoretical and practical. First, as political scientists, we need to grapple with the contradiction between the new American state and the Weberian presumption of the monopoly of legal force. What does it mean for a state capacity to share legitimate use of force between the people and the state? I hope my presentation answers to you the mystery of who aspires to be Scalia's able-bodied men of the nation, but the court still leaves a lot of questions unanswered. One pressing one has to do with the public performance of armed citizenship. Are we entering a future where people will retreat from public spaces, such as parks and farmer markets, because government can no longer keep guns out of there? Are people going to be scared to participate in political protests because the Proud Boys are standing by? Will we be scared to drop off a ballot because some citizen soldiers are defending the spot with AR-15s and beer coolers? Are we on the road to completely transforming political representation because elected officials refuse to run as a result of threats and violence, and those who run completely change their home style, steering away from in-person meetings and town halls and restricting access? I don't have answers to these questions. The only thing that I can tell you is that race, rights, and rifles will remain ideologically and politically entangled in American political life for a long time to come. Thank you. The question was, what is the relationship between various hunting and sports shooting or organizations and the NRA? So, the NRA has an arm that represents those groups as well, so it coordinates other groups that especially focus on hunting and sports shooting, but also does its other political, more directly political work. So all of these organizations are related, and there is some competition, not so much with the sports organizations, but with the more extreme political organization, like the Gun Owners of America are on the right of the NRA and have become far more pushy on certain things. So the NRA has lost some membership to them, apparently. They're more scared of them. But basically, the NRA has for many years been the coordinator of everybody who's involved with firearms in different capacities. So the question is, how does the urban-rural divide, which is very prominent in gun culture, how does that fit with this story? Urban and rural are code words for race and for nativity. So we have known, and we have a lot of evidence from experimental studies and from a variety of work across the board, that the term urban means black people, and the term rural means white Christian virtuous people, for the most part. And it's actually very interesting that the one time that the NRA's periodicals actually feature an African-American gun activist on the cover, his name is Colion Noir, and he is a lawyer, and he lives in a city. I think he is from Chicago. And they actually call him an urban a gun activist. And I'm like, that is very curious, because I had my students search the entire magazine again to see if anybody else is being called urban, associated with urban, and they're not. So I think it relates to the race and also the immigrant dimension. They're code words for that. So the comment was that the presentation was unfair and unbalanced to the NRA and not productive in terms of contemporary problems, and also that the NRA took a turn for the worse in the 80s because of Wayne LaPierre. The NRA, I did not mention, the history, the contemporary history of the NRA is well covered by a lot of scholars and journalists. It's true, in 1977 there was an internal coup, the Cincinnati coup in the NRA, where the hardliners who believed that there should be no compromise on guns took over the association. And from there, they developed a very strong argument about the Second Amendment, as an individual right, and not only as an individual right of defense, but as a political right against tyranny. And my book is basically about that and the origins of that aspect of American political culture, that it's not just the contemporary NRA, but these ideas have a very long trajectory, long lineage. I'm a member of the NRA as well, so is my husband. It's actually an organization that has a very interesting history as a basically part, very important part of the Department of Defense. They did a lot of work to prepare the Army, but their work was also imbued with the ideologies of the time, and they worked within the context, the historical context, that was true of the time. So they also, though, brought this ideology along with them after the changes of the 1960s. The defense establishment changed, but the NRA's ideology didn't change very much, and that's obvious from its magazines. So I am sorry that you feel that the presentation was unbalanced. Has there been any change to the NRA since the ousting of Wayne LaPierre? I don't know. It's too early to tell. Definitely what I see from their magazines is that they are trying to appeal to new constituencies, but the way that they seem to appeal to them is with a specific lens that is, you know, their traditional lens. So I don't see them ideologically as changing, because I can tell you that, and probably I'm speaking for some of the women in here, that what attracts me to products is not them being pink, even though I love pink. You just are not going to sell me on a gun by showing me, a young woman in pink shorts with a big pink AR-15 is not an ad that's made for me. So clearly, they are not really listening. They're focused on their main constituency, which is white men, and older white men at that. And they're also trying to sort of bring in these other constituencies, but not really go to them where they are. And a key issue, for example, is like they do not talk about domestic violence. Like, you're talking about, you know, women needing guns for protection, and the word domestic violence is absent from the magazines ever. And again, we looked, we counted. That is a problem because, you know, they're limiting themselves. They're sort of staying away from the social issues that actually relate to real women's lives. I see them doing marketing campaigns, but I don't think that they are actually truly engaging with the social problems that undergird gun violence. Their only solution to gun violence is more guns. And the slogan is more guns, less crime. That's all they have to offer. Every time that there is an uptick in crime, or every time that there is a school shooting, it's like, put more guns in there. There's no discussion about other things. So, 1967, the Black Panthers walked into the Sacramento State House in California with big guns on them, open carry, because at the time that was allowed. And within days, California passed gun control, and then the federal government also passed gun control by 1968. And the NRA supposedly, and it's only supposedly, supported these efforts. In reality, the NRA was trying to thread the needle in a way. They knew it was happening, so they wanted to basically be part of the process in order to make sure that they would get the most watered-down version of the legislation. So it looked like they were supporting it, and that's what's been reported, but really it was, if they realize they're a very smart organization, if you stay out of the process and just say, I reject this, you have no say on the product. So they participated in the process, and they watered down the Gun Control Act of 1968. And definitely they were very much against the Black Panthers. They stated in their editorials, they call them, and I never understood the title. It's called Black Panthers and Blind Kittens, and they say the Black Panthers are racist, and we are not. We are ecumenical. We accept everybody. They're racist. They definitely use implicit racial cues to say urban crime, and, you know, you need guns for urban crime and all of that. At the same time, right now, they are in a crossroads because older white men are literally dying. So, you know, the population is shrinking, and it is their key demographic is older white men, and actually middle and upper middle class white men who can buy products that are pretty expensive. Guns are not cheap for the most part, and especially if you add all the various attachments to it. Like, it is a consumer culture, and it's, when you start buying these things, you buy all kinds of other things that relate to it. So they need to expand the market because their market is shrinking. So they're trying to have these forays into women mostly, white women, but also now African-American women, that they're not going into black men, because I think that their core demographic who reads the magazine may not feel very comfortable seeing these young black men with guns in the pictures. It's a very difficult path to navigate. And the way they do it is sort of with a white male audience, I think, in their minds, because at my class at UIC is a very diverse, the University of Illinois Chicago where I teach is very diverse, and I have 22 students in my class, of which only one is white. So I showed them that picture, and I asked, you know, what do you think? One Latina woman raised her hand, and she said, Professor, I think this is a white man's vision of what a black woman should look like. It's not how I see myself or my group or we see our group. So there's this tension there in the presentation, which is very interesting. Again, it's sort of, they're grappling to sort of get this new audience but not deal with the base problems that these other groups really care about. So to try to fit them into this mold, and it doesn't quite work. The Gun Owners Association, which is a newer group, and the Shooting Sports Foundation organization, Second Amendment organizations, there are a variety of those. There are also state-level ones. I know that in their origins, which were in the 1980s, the Gun Owners Association or so, was far more radical than the NRA, far more absolutist, and the NRA had a hard time sort of navigating that line between making some concessions, especially in the early 90s, and not losing membership to Gun Owners for America, who were very, very hardliners, but I don't know what they look like today. I know that they're gaining membership for sure, and there are like a ton of them. There are many, many organizations now across the country.
You were just listening to Alexandra Falindra on Race, Rights, and Rifles. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in late April 2024. Alexandra Falindra is professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's the author of Race, Rights, and Rifles, The Origins of the NRA and Contemporary Gun Culture. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Noam Chomsky, Ilan Pape, Medea Benjamin, Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, and Naomi Klein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Alexandra Falindra on Race, Rights, and Rifles, and for her book, Race, Rights, and Rifles, The Origins of the NRA and Contemporary Gun Culture, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Matt Laubach recorded the program. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with the great tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins performing Freedom Suite.
Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, here in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1 in Burnaby. We just danced our way awake with Soul Makassa.
Yeah, I'm a young black man who uses art to champion and celebrate blackness, as well as creating art that showcases black men as comprehensive, emotionally intelligent human beings.
Right now, we are going to hear a spoken word rap piece by slam poetry winner JB, the First Lady. That is Lady Johnny Proby singing Don't Quit, and here at Speak Up, we do not quit.
Love, laughter, argument, and encouragement. The words are too few for the essence of you.
And it shows just one of the ways that you can take feelings of pain and transform them to love and recognition. Today, we're exploring senior issues through digital media and the creative arts. My guests are Leslie Riemann, the director of the 411 Center, and Joel Flynn from Podstream. This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, welcoming you to the Friday Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon What You've Heard show. We have conversations about social issues, culture, and creative arts events, potent samplings about special months like Health Month, Black History Month, Women's Month, Nutrition Month, and more. See you Friday at 10 a.m.